Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday, the 2nd of February, these are our main stories. The US says plans have been approved for retaliatory strikes against Iranian targets in Iraq and Syria. At the same time, President Biden has imposed sanctions on some Jewish settlers who've committed violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The World Health Organization has issued a warning about rising global cancer cases, saying poorer countries are likely to see the current mortality rate double by 2050. Also in this podcast,
for Lewis to probably finish his career with Ferrari, it's like a dream come true for him, I should imagine, because going to Ferrari is everything. The couple of years I had at Ferrari was a dream come true.
The 7 times Formula One champion Lewis Hamilton is leaving Mercedes to join Ferrari. The US says it's now approved plans for a series of strikes against Iranian personnel and facilities in Iraq and Syria. US officials told CBS News, the BBC's American partner, that the action will be carried out over a number of days. Weather will be a factor in the timing. Washington has been preparing to hit back at Iranian-backed militias after 3 US troops were killed in a drone strike at a military base in Jordan on Sunday. But at the same time, the US is trying to avoid further escalating the violence in the Middle East. On Thursday, the Defence Secretary, Lloyd Austin, gave his first news conference since it emerged at the start of the year that he had cancer. He said the US would not tolerate attacks on American troops.
This is a dangerous moment in the Middle East. We will continue to work to avoid a wider conflict in the region. But we will take all necessary actions to defend the United States, our interests, and our people. And we will respond when we choose, where we choose, and how we choose.
At the same time, the US, which has faced sharp criticism for its support of Israel's military actions in Gaza, has taken the highly unusual step of imposing sanctions on 4 Israeli settlers who have attacked Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank. I got more on all these developments with our US State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
There has been approval now for strikes that would take place against targets in Syria and Iraq. These would be over several days. And crucially, that these would include Iranian personnel and facilities. Now, the significance of that is that, you know, the US has made abundantly clear it sees Iran-backed groups, Kataib Hezbollah, namely, as one of them, as being involved in the fatal strike at the weekend against its forces. Iran-backed, Iran-supplied as well. So that's why they're talking about Iranian facilities and personnel. But what is not in this apparent approval is Iranian territory. So there is no suggestion that Iran itself would be targeted. Now, remember, President Biden has been under huge pressure, not least from some of the most hawkish voices on Iran in Washington, namely a number of Republican senators, to target and strike Iran itself as a way to meaningfully deter these Iranian-backed groups. But I think now what you have is this sense of more detail, really, on this way they intend to sort of calibrate this. They think that by targeting personnel, they can deter further attacks, but at the same time not draw Iran itself into a direct confrontation with the US.
And it was significant that weather was mentioned.
basically what was being said was that cloud cover creates a problem in terms of targeting, because they, you know, they say they don't want to hit uninvolved civilians. But that to me felt like a sort of explanation as to why there's already been a 3 or 4 day delay over any strikes taking place. I think what the administration is doing, it's in a holding pattern while it sort of fully works out what it is going to strike and when and for how long. But at the same time, it's trying to keep those voices that are calling for more strident action, trying to keep those to some extent satisfied.
So you've got the US talking about hitting Iranian targets. It's strongly backing the Israeli military in its war against Hamas. But at the same time, the US has now announced that it's imposing sanctions on some Jewish settlers.
It is, and I think what's become increasingly clear over the last sort of month to 6 weeks is how irritated Joe Biden is with Benjamin Netanyahu, frankly, over the fact that he would see him as having failed to or be unwilling to rein in the ultra-nationalist element in the Israeli government. Now, these are people whose sort of stock and base of support are Israeli settlers who have been involved with these attacks on Palestinians, smashing up, you know, Palestinian villages and property. Joe Biden has increasingly made it clear he's not going to tolerate that. We already knew that they were planning visa travel bans so that those people won't be able to get to the US, but this is in addition to that. So it's talking about freezing any assets they have in the US bank accounts, but also significantly it talks about donations to those individuals also coming under the terms of the executive order. And that, I think, is quite an important development, because there are lots of donations that come from the US to Israeli settlements, and what this is making clear is any money that the US deems is tied to individuals who carry out attacks in the West Bank against Palestinians, that is now the subject of a prohibition in the form of a presidential executive order.
Tom Bateman. Israel has criticised the sanctions imposed by its close ally. A statement by the office of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "Israel acts against all lawbreakers everywhere, so there is no room for exceptional measures in this regard." The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has said the new support deal for Ukraine, agreed by European leaders, sends a strong message to President Putin. EU countries have approved a €50 billion or $54 billion package of military and financial assistance. The four-year deal was passed unanimously despite previous resistance from Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford sent this report from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
This was the deal Ukraine needed and that Europe had worried it couldn't deliver. In the end, Hungarian opposition to the funding for Kyiv was overcome with a mixture of coercion and concession. In Ukraine, there's relief and gratitude.
I'm grateful for your decision on the financial instrument.
Addressing EU leaders in Brussels via video link, Volodymyr Zelensky stressed the importance of EU unity in helping Kyiv. Almost 2 years into Russia's full-scale invasion, that solidarity is an important counter to talk of Ukraine fatigue in the West. It's also crucial as an aid package from the United States is still being blocked by Congress. That was a point President Zelensky underlined.
Europe today sends a signal across the Atlantic and the world that the international rules-based order will withstand all challenges. Europe sets the tone for global affairs with its unity.
But this deal is about more than symbols and signals. It's about hard cash. With all its domestic revenue being sucked up to fund the fighting, Ukraine's government needs money to pay for pensions and people's salaries, even to keep the lights on here. That's also critical to maintaining domestic support for the war effort, keeping up morale. In Brussels, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said the deal just done proved Europe's unwavering commitment to Kyiv.
We all know that Ukraine is fighting for us, so we will support them with the necessary funding and provide them with the much-needed predictability they deserve. And I think these €50 billion for 4 years also send a very strong message to Putin.
Officials here stress that this is a war Ukraine is fighting for the security of all Europe, that Russia and Vladimir Putin are a threat to all. They argue the funds from Brussels are not aid, but investment. And as the money's been promised over 4 years, it also offers Ukraine a little more of the stability it needs.
Sarah Rainsford in Ukraine. Now, a quick message from Oliver Conway.
2 years on from Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we're making a special Q&A edition of the pod with the experts at Ukrainecast. But to do that, we need your questions. So if you want to know what life is like in occupied parts of Ukraine at the moment, whether Ukrainian strikes on Crimea are damaging Russian morale, or what a peace deal might look like, now's your chance. Please email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk and, if possible, record a voice note so we can play it in the podcast. Thanks.
Returning now to this podcast, the World Health Organization is warning the number of cancer cases globally will rise rapidly in the coming decades. WHO experts say this reflects a growing and aging global population, with tobacco, alcohol, obesity and air pollution major factors. They say poorer countries with the fewest resources to tackle cancer will experience the biggest proportional rise. Rebecca Kesby got more details from Dr. Freddie Bray of the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer.
We estimate that there will be over 35 million new cancer cases by 2050. That represents around a 77% increase from the estimated 20 million new cases that we see around about today, 2022, and that is a rapidly growing cancer burden. It reflects both changes in the population. We're getting older. The populations are growing. It's going to be closer to 9.7 billion worldwide by 2050. So it reflects the changes in the population, but also possibly the changes in the risk factors that could be linked to socioeconomic development as well.
Yeah, this is worldwide. So what are some of the factors that are leading to these cancers?
Lung cancer is the most commonly occurring cancer worldwide. There are about 2.5 million new cancer cases in 2022, linked mainly, of course, to tobacco. And there's a need to control tobacco, obviously, worldwide, and it relates to cigarette smoking. There may be other factors, such as in China, it's linked in part to air pollution, particularly among women and other Asian countries. Breast cancer is a leading cancer in women, both in terms of new cases of cancer and in terms of deaths from cancer. So that's obviously a very important cause of cancer in women.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because the results or the statistics on that are really interesting, in that women from lower income countries are far less likely to be diagnosed, and certainly earlier. And so they're actually at much greater risk of not surviving breast cancer, I think, from these figures you've released today.
That is correct. I mean, there is definitely a disproportionate impact on underserved populations, and indeed an urgent need to address cancer inequities worldwide. We do see that, you know, some of the highest incidence of breast cancer is in very high income countries, but the highest mortality is in the lowest income countries. And that relates to factors in the context of disparities in cancer treatment outcomes that exist between high and low income countries. We need to detect cancers early, such as breast cancer, and we need to treat them early so that women can survive these cancers. And that there are certainly opportunities to do that, and countries need to really invest in cancer care.
I mean, cancer is now so much more preventable, more treatable, more survivable, but it does seem as if we're going backwards, and especially where there's economic disparity between countries.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we do these predictions is really to show how important this is. Certainly the World Health Organization is working intensively with governments to develop finance, implement policies that promote cancer care and cancer control. But there does need to be major investments to really tackle these global inequities and cancer outcomes. It's not just a resource issue. There really needs to be political will. This is going to be one of the leading diseases that we see worldwide in the 21st century, and we need to act now.
Dr. Freddie Bray from the WHO. Now, the idea of ghost ships haunts the collective memories of seafaring nations. Ships such as the Marie Celeste, which was discovered deserted and adrift in the Atlantic in 1872. Now, a mysterious shipwreck has been discovered off the east coast of Canada more than a century after it sank. Terry Egan reports.
Gordon Blackmore was out scanning for seabirds on the shores of Newfoundland when he saw a ghostly shadow in the water. neither a bird nor a plane. It instead turned out to be a ship. Not any old ship, mind. This one is nearly 25 metres long and is a mystery, thought to date back to the 19th century. Here's Gordon's mum, Wanda.
Come in the door and he said, Mum, he said, do you know of any shipwrecks down on the beach? I went, no. And then he showed me the video and took the pictures that he had taken. And I was like, Gordon, is that wooden dowels they're keeping it together? And he said, yes, Mum. I said, well, boy, that's probably at least 150 years old.
Cape Ray, near where the ship was found, is a coastal town of 350 people and used to be on a high-traffic shipping route. Residents there hope to find out more about how some of their ancestors might have been lost in the water, or, as Gordon put it, whether there are any lost souls still aboard. But depending on the wood involved, the ship could have been constructed entirely elsewhere, such as in Europe. As it stands, though, little more is known, neither about the ship nor about how it washed up. Neil Burgess is president of the Shipwreck Preservation Society.
Newfoundland really sticks out into the North Atlantic. It's battered by storms throughout the winter from the south and from the north. We get really huge surf and swells here in the ocean, and that's going to tend to uncover these things. The mythology with Newfoundland is that there's 10,000 shipwrecks around our shores.
Nor might this be the end of the ship's voyage. Hopefully it would become a place for remembrance, but could instead be damaged by sea ice or even dragged back out by the strong winds. Either way, it's likely to become a target for souvenir hunters, any of which threats might do vastly more damage than being submerged in the deep for 100 years or so.
Terry Egan reporting. Still to come, a very unusual theft.
You're kidding me! Right here local! What would somebody do with a polar bear? That's crazy!
Thieves in Canada have made off with a stuffed polar bear.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour. And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A new game called Palworld, a violent satire of the Pokemon franchise, has become one of the fastest-selling independent video games ever. It sounds like this. The gaming industry is extremely lucrative. In 2023, game subscriptions and sales combined brought in over $50 billion worldwide, dwarfing both music and box office revenues for last year. Lauren Bergen is news editor at the online PC Games End magazine. She told Paul Henley more about Palworld.
Palworld, kind of at its core, is this kind of survival game that blends the kind of general survival elements with the creature collecting elements that we've seen, obviously, in Pokemon. So I think the thing about Palworld that makes it so unique or special is that, obviously, a lot of the designs have been very much compared to Nintendo's Pokemon. And I think that because when you go out into the world, it's, you know, you've got Pokemon, but they've also got AK-47s. That is one of the things that made people so interested in this game. It is the game that I don't think anybody knew they needed until they watched the trailers and went, what on earth is this? But when you actually do play it, the gameplay is very dissimilar to Pokemon. There's the multiplayer aspect. You can walk around the world. You can see other players, which you can't do in Pokemon at the minute. And just generally, there is more of a purpose to collecting the pals, which is, you know, obviously the equivalent of the creature type archetype.
Just glancing at the graphics, I mean, the creatures involved really do look like Pokemon characters. That must be deliberate.
it certainly seems that there is a similarity, and I think that that's what has drawn people to it, and obviously it has been noticed online.
Now, Nintendo could have stamped on this from the outset, the owners of Pokemon, but they haven't, have they? Intriguing.
No, they haven't. What they have said, though, is recently they did release a statement which does not name Palworld directly, but certainly alludes to it, saying that it hasn't granted permission for anyone to use Pokemon's intellectual property or assets in that game, which presumably is Palworld. And then it does say that it plans to investigate and take appropriate measures to address any acts of infringement upon their intellectual property rights related to Pokemon. So they are clearly interested in what's going on, and obviously we're not sure how long they've actually been watching this game, but obviously with the hype and the backlash from the Pokemon community in general, it has certainly been brought to their attention. So it will be interesting to see where that goes.
Lauren Bergen from PC Games and Magazine. Next to sport, and Formula One driver Lewis Hamilton has made a shock move from Mercedes to Ferrari for the 2025 season. It follows years of rumours that the seven-time world champion wanted to join the Italian team, viewed by many as Formula One's most glamorous. Here's our sports news correspondent, Laura Scott.
The man from Stevenage comes across the line, wins the Turkish Grand Prix, and becomes the most successful Formula One driver of all time.
It was the moment in November 2020 when Lewis Hamilton rewrote the record books behind the wheel of a Mercedes. It was his seventh World Championship title, his sixth with the team. Over more than a decade, the partnership has brought huge success. So the news today of Hamilton's impending move at the end of this season is seismic. But there have been clues. Ferrari have long been interested in Hamilton, and his fortunes have changed, having not won a title since 2020 or a race for two seasons. Yet he still believes he can achieve more in Formula One before he retires. And the former Ferrari driver Nigel Mansell highlighted the lure of the Italian team.
For Lewis to probably finish his career with Ferrari, it's like a dream come true for him, I should imagine, because going to Ferrari is everything. The couple of years I had at Ferrari was a dream come true. It's so romantic driving for him. The atmosphere of the Tifosi there in Italy, they'll just embrace Lewis.
The most successful driver in Formula One history is determined to move ahead of Michael Schumacher by winning an eighth world title. And it would appear he believes he needs to move teams to make that happen, sending shockwaves through his sport in the process.
Laura Scott. The pyramids of Giza in Egypt are one of the world's most famous archaeological wonders. Constructed more than 4,000 years ago to house the tombs of the country's pharaohs, they're visited by millions of tourists every year. Now the Egyptian government has started a project to cover one of the pyramids with granite blocks and restore it to what it says was its original state. But the plan has alarmed many experts concerned about what this will do to the ancient structure, and there's been a storm of criticism on social media. Our correspondent in Cairo, Sally Nabil, told me more.
It's a project between Egypt and Japan aiming to cover the smallest pyramid in granite. It's supposed to take 3 years. The government describes it as the project of the century, and it says that it will make the smallest pyramid even more attractive to visitors from different parts of the world. And once this news was spread, it caused an uproar on social media, because people were becoming very, very suspicious about this so-called restoration process. Back thousands and thousands of years ago when the pyramids were first built, it was believed that they were originally covered in granite that was eaten up over the years. So given this uproar, now there are reports that say that a committee will be formed that will carry out further research and studies to see if this is a viable project and if work can continue on site.
And can you explain to us why there's been this uproar and indeed why Japan is involved?
Actually, why Japan is involved, this is a question that no one has answered. But we know that they have allocated some money for this project. And generally speaking, the government do not really release much information to the public. They do not give details at all. So the project has outraged a lot of people and a lot of archaeologists as well, because the Egyptian government has history of what experts say messing up with archaeological sites. critics say that this government has already knocked down a huge number of historic tombs, that some of them are 1,000 years old, to make way for building roads and building bridges and expanding some infrastructure project. And they did not really care about the UNESCO-certified tombs. So that, given that this is the history of this government, a lot of people say that they won't handle the restoration process of the small pyramid with care. And some even said that this pyramid might eventually fall. And they likened this restoration process to straightening the Pisa Tower, for example, in Italy. The way the government has been justifying it is that when the project has been concluded, it will attract even more tourists from around the world. And for this country, tourism is a lifeline to the Egyptian economy, which is already struggling.
Sally Nabil in Cairo. Now, you might expect expensive jewellery and money to be the obvious targets for a robbery, but thieves in Canada went after something a little more unusual and a whole lot bigger, as Rebecca Wood reports.
It was on a cold night in January, so cold in fact that thermometers dropped to minus 30 degrees Celsius. Most people retreated indoors to sit it out, but not one group of hardy thieves in Alberta. They used it as an opportunity. Their destination, a resort near Edmonton. And their target, a heavy 225-kilogram stuffed polar bear called Harry. It was a theft that left locals in shock, like this man who spoke to CTV News.
You're kidding me! Right here local! What would somebody do with a polar bear? That's crazy!
The thieves severed steel cables holding the stuffed animal in place before dragging their prize down a flight of stairs and out the front door, presumably into some sort of large getaway vehicle. Wanda Rowe, the director of the resort, says it happened on the one day it was so cold there was no one and nothing working.
It's irony, right? Stolen on the coldest day of the year and a polar bear from central Alberta.
Reportedly worth tens of thousands of dollars, they're keen to have Harry back. Royal Canadian Mounted Police have asked residents to keep a lookout. An animal that surely wouldn't be too hard to spot. He's white, more than 3 metres tall, and may be in the company of two stuffed raccoons that were reported stolen from the same place back in August.
Rebecca Wood. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.